Welcome to a Close Call with Death podcast series. My name is Bob Howard, and this is a Close Call with Death, where I get a chance to talk with people that are just like me, that have had close calls with death and survived. As for me, I've had 12 close calls. My guests, they've gained a pivotal understanding of what a gift life is and how fortunate we are to elude death and carry on. So now, enjoy the show. Today, I'm going to be interviewing Stein Rosequist. And Stein was brought to me by another person that has been on the podcast, Brett Hutchings. Brett has known by his call name, Hutch, as a helicopter pilot, worked for AirMed in the past and Utah Highway Patrol. And Brett was talking to me and said, you've got to interview Stein because he's got a heck of a story of survival and a close call with death, period. So I reached out to Stein and asked him if he would be on the show, and he's here with us today. Stein is a nurse medic for Life Flight, and it's a Life Flight service, a med service that is provided by Intermountain Healthcare here in Utah. And Stein was dispatched with his team out into a fog on a terrible stormy night that I believe there was like a multi-car pileup accident going on out there in the fog, and Life Flight was going out to take care of the scene and bring back patients that need to receive care immediately, and they crashed. Stein is the lone survivor of that crash, and we're going to talk to him today and get the inside on this story. And I'm just so interested to see what happened that night and how life has changed since then. So, Stein, thank you so much for being on the show. So, Stein, I'm so excited to have you here tonight, and just gave a little bit of color on what the incident was that we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to get into major detail, but before we do that, let's talk a little bit about you. Tell me about who you are, where you grew up, how old you are now, and things like that, so that when we get into it, we'll know a little bit more about your background.
Okay. My name is Stein Rosequist. I was born and raised in Poundville, Utah. Grew up with six brothers and three sisters. So there was
large family,
lots of us sleeping on top of each other. And we, out of high school, I got a scholarship to go into a medical field, and I used it for nursing.
Hey, and you know what, Stein, was that something that you were totally into? You were really looking forward to getting into medical all your life since you were a kid or anything? Or
it was just something I had an interest in because of a class I took my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
And it's always fascinating to me how a teacher can influence you for the rest of your life.
Have you gone back, and just out of curiosity, have you gone back and talked to that teacher and let him know how much their teaching really took you in that direction?
You know what? I haven't. I wish I had tried harder. They're not teaching this class at this high school anymore.
Is that teacher still alive?
And I don't know, but that's...
Well, if that teacher is still alive, you need to get this podcast recording to them and let them hear what you were
absolutely
thinking.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. So, you know, I started in the nursing a year after getting out of high school, and I liked it. I liked what I was doing, and had no desire to really do anything else. And I had to put the brakes on. I think I was about 20 years old, and I had to pause my life for a minute, For 2 years, I went on a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Where did you go?
And I went, well, see, I was planning for Central South America, for sure. My dad went to Uruguay. My brother went to Ecuador. Another one went to Chile. So, for sure, this Spanish-speaking, I opened it up, and it was Cleveland, Ohio. And I was like,
Spanish-speaking, Cleveland, Ohio.
You got to be kidding, you know. And so.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It was fascinating. It was incredible.
The church was forcing you to become a Cleveland Brown fan.
You know what's weird is that at the moment, Cleveland was really good. Their baseball team, not so much. But the
football team was on fire.
But the football team was doing really well.
That's awesome.
And so it was kind of fun to be there. And we had great times. But when I came home, I started working at LDS Hospital.
Okay.
And my wife, Michelle, she was working there too. She had just graduated from BYU. And so she's working there.
What was she?
And she was a nurse also, and it was interesting because I fell in love with her right away, you know, and so
love at first sight.
Oh man! And so we dated for about 1 year, mm-hmm. and got married, and we moved out to South Jordan. Because her parents lived in South Jordan, and I thought we'll live in South Jordan for a year, and then we'll move back up to Bountiful or Davis County. Mm-hmm. And I've been out here for 31 years.
Never left.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Absolutely best thing ever. And so as I start working at LDS Hospital, I graduated to different units. I was working in the cardiac ICU. I was working in the emergency room. And so then I that's when I applied and started flying with Life Flight. And I started flying initially on their fixed wing team. And we would go a little bit further out than the helicopter could reach. And after doing that for a couple years, I applied and was accepted to fly on the rotor wing team. And so with the rotor wing team, it was like doing hoist rescues and all the training involved and teaching the education that we got every week and on and on. And it was just, it was fun. It was exciting. And
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
I've talked to helicopter pilot crews and at kind of like banquets and things like that, big corporate gatherings, and they've got the floor. When they're talking, everybody listens. It is so dynamic and exciting, and it may be just in the course of regular work day for them, but for the rest of us, that's heroic action, and you're putting yourselves in danger. But you're doing so much for the people around to help people survive. It's beautiful.
Right. I think it's very rewarding. And so it's easy to go to work. It's something that you look forward to. And so you just want to be able to do something every day that puts a smile on your face.
So let me ask you this. Did you have just a little bit of ego going on when you put on that flight uniform and you put on your Life Flight jumpsuit? Did you feel like Top Gun guy?
Let me put it this way. that whole uniform, and then now add a helmet over that and then put the sun visor down. And I remember landing on I-15. There was a crash. And the person had tumbled, and the car's in the median. And highway patrol stops traffic both ways because they don't want people rubbernecking, going in the opposite direction, and then have another accident.
Right.
So they stop traffic. And when we land the helicopter, the person sitting in the front seat will open up their door and they look back to the tail. So we're clearing the tail rotor.
Yes.
And so they, so that's usually the paramedic up front. And so as the nurse in the back, I would open up the sliding door, put my foot out on that skid, and turn around and look at the back of the helicopter to clear the tail on my side.
Because you can get cut in half if you walk back there and get too close.
Right. And so what we're coming down, we're landing, you know, 50 feet, 40 feet, and we're just making sure, because once the pilot goes past, it's out of their field of vision, and everyone is looking up at you. All this traffic is stopped. I mean,
oh,
when you talk
gosh.
About an ego rush, it's
yes.
like, oh, man.
You're like the cavalry just arrived.
Yeah, I got this, guys. Don't worry. Don't worry. You know, we're here to save the day. And you had to be careful that way. That you didn't come off like that.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
Oh,
absolutely.
Gosh.
Absolutely.
That's super cool.
So
let me ask you this. How old were you then? You were like 22 or something when you were getting into this, or early 20s?
I started at LDS Hospital early 20s. I was like 23, I think it was.
Yeah.
And so I started flying when I was probably about 25.
Okay. And how old are you now?
I'm 54.
Okay.
And so I start flying, and I've got a couple years of fixed wing experience, and now I'm flying rotor wing and on the...
You guys call it rotor wing, that's helicopter.
Yeah, and on the helicopter, so it would be a nurse, usually, is how we're staffed, as is a nurse and a paramedic if we're going for an adult.
Okay.
Because
you can't have too much weight in that. You can't have a great big six-man crew or anything
in
there.
Right, totally. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if we're going for a child, someone 18 or under, mm-hmm. we would have a nurse. So I'm an adult nurse, and then I would fly with a pediatric nurse out of the PICU at Primary Children's.
Okay.
And so all of the pediatric nurses are all pediatric ICU trained. And so... we would, all these stories are starting to flood my mind of all these different times we went out and picked up things here and there. And
you know what? Just thinking about that, Stein, all those missions that you went out on, did you ever really worry about going out in that helicopter, going out to a crash site or some kind of incident? Did you ever worry about that you guys could go down, that you could crash or anything?
It's something that really me and my wife had a heart-to-heart talk about. But our talk was, let's make sure everything's in line, because I wasn't going to survive a small aircraft or a small helicopter crash.
And nobody would, right? Nobody in the crew.
We didn't plan for that at all.
Yes.
So our plan was just make sure we had our accidental death and disability up to par.
Up to speed, yeah.
Yep, that kind of stuff. And any supplemental life insurance. And so my wife and kids would be taken care of. That was our thought.
Yeah.
That was our thought. And it's weird how things get just adjusted just a little bit. It's pretty much that, because every time we went out, I felt safe.
Well, you know what? It's usually the rule of thumb that if you plan for things, if you put safeguards in place, that nothing will happen. It's when you don't do anything to protect your family or anything that things could go terribly wrong.
Right.
But so right. You're in this job where you're a nurse medic going out on these things. Let's talk about and lead up to your close call with death. And this is seriously a scene, an episode that doesn't happen every day. I want you to talk to me about that day, that what it was like, what were the conditions, what went wrong?
So we, me and my wife were working the same shift. She was working in the ICU, and I'm flying on the helicopter for a night shift. It was,
and this is out of the same hospital, same ER. You're correct. Going out on a helicopter. She's working right there in correct. The intensive care unit.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And so as we're driving in to the hospital, it was January 10th. So the time of year was perfect for the inversion. And so if you're not familiar with the inversion here in Salt Lake, because of our bad air quality, like anything, any heavy air just gets trapped down here in the valley. Mm-hmm. And the best weather is up at the ski resorts. And so we are driving in, and it is slow going because the fog and smog is just so thick, and it's just so hard to see. And like was mentioned earlier, there was a big accident that slowed up traffic. It was just, and so I remember having this conversation and saying to my wife, I was like, if the weather's going to be this bad, we're not flying anywhere. And she said, well, that's fine, because you can just come and hang out with me in the ICU, mm-hmm. you know. And we got to the hospital, and we go our separate ways to different departments. And as my wife is working, she's working in cardiac ICU.
Was it busy that night?
And as it happens, it was so, the unit was so busy. And working in cardiac care, it wouldn't astound you that they had a patient that was in an arrest. And so there's a lot of nurses that are running, coming and going, trying to resuscitate this patient. And very busy, and as Michelle, my wife, is helping to take care of this patient, she just thought it was weird when she heard the helicopter power up and take off. And she's just like, I didn't think they were going anywhere.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Did she have just a... What was going through her mind and her feelings at that time?
You know, absolutely. She was a blank slate. She was nothing at the moment. And she was kind of focused on this patient. And half hour goes by. They're still working on this patient. And the secretary comes to the room. She comes to the door. If you can imagine this scene, you know, a couple doctors, three nurses, two techs, and just the mess on the bed as they're trying to resuscitate this patient. And she was like, the secretary says, hey, Michelle, I've got a phone call for you. And my wife looks at her like, you got to be kidding me. Like,
I'm kind of busy here.
You see what's going on here. And she says, can you take a message? And she said, it's your sister. And she said she was watching the news. And they are saying that Lifelike crashed.
Oh, my gosh.
And and so she is calling to see if Stein is okay. And she's like, I don't know anything. And so she steps out of the room, and she walks down the hall. At the time, our dispatch center was right outside of this ICU. Mm-hmm. And so she walks into the dispatch center, and Connie, the dispatcher, is there. And my wife looks at her, and she knows my wife, and she's like, it's Stein's helicopter. Mm. We can't,
gives me chills.
We can't get any contact with them. They are not responding to us, and we don't know where they are. And so my wife just went out and just kind of started pacing. she knew if she went, like, maybe to a patient room or to an empty room, like a TV might come on, she might see some news that she didn't want to see at the moment. And so it was at the point where she was like, I don't know what to do, you know, a little distraught. And so for us, we got a call from Twilla Valley Dispatch to go on a single car wreck out by Wendover. And it was this couple, that was, you know, when I went out on this flight, I was 32 years old, and I would have said this middle-aged couple, and they were in their early 50s. Now that I'm in my mid-50s, I don't know if I would say this middle-aged couple or not. It gives you a little perspective, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And they were heading out to Elko to buy a car. And so the two of them were driving out there, and they were going to each drive a car back. And whoever was driving got off on the soft shoulder and rolled their car. And so we were headed after them, and they said AirMed already tried to go on this call.
And AirMed is the other flight service by another hospital network versus Life Flight of your Intermountain Healthcare.
Correct. And so AirMed is out of the University of Utah.
Okay.
And so AirMed they tried to go, but they said the fog was too thick, and so they returned to the university path.
And they're safe. They're back. They're done. They're safe. But then you guys were
dispatched. And so they call us, and Twilla Valley Dispatch said, hey, someone's already tried. Do you think you can? And so our pilot, he is a Vietnam vet. He's been flying for 35 years, I think. And he trains pilots how to fly IFR, like instrument, like you can't see anything out of the canopy in front of you. I'm going to teach you how to just fly an instrument. And that's what airline pilots do it all the time when they're flying through clouds and stuff. But helicopters, we only fly if we can see. So we have to have visual. And Craig, our pilot, he used to teach this, how to make sure, like, if you get in this situation.
Right.
And so he actually called up to the university and talked with their pilot up there, and he told them what the conditions were, and he checks his meteorological data, and he's like, hey, I think we can give it a shot. And for me, I'm missing a lot of my memory. I'm missing probably about 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after. And the only thing I remember is being up on our helipad, which is on the roof of LDS Hospital, and looking out and just seeing a dark, starry night. And so we took off and headed to go across the field of Salt Lake International Airport. And there was so much air traffic coming in because of the weather. It was slow. Planes were missing the approach, and they're pulling out and going around for another try. So there was a lot of planes circling around. And when the tower made a gap big enough for us to fly across, kind of from like a Redwood Road out to the west side of the airport. And when we got out to the west side of the airport, Craig, our pilot, said, no, I need to go back. I need to go back. And the tower said, you can't. I mean, I've got all these planes landing.
Yeah.
Right where you they're like, stop. No, you can't. And Craig agreed to that. They said, can we hold you over there? And he said, yes. And it was our one of our chief pilots that was guessing. He said Craig would have never agreed to hold over there on the west side of the airport if he didn't feel safe.
Right.
He was like, well, that why would he do that? There's no sense in that. And so we held on the west side of the airport. And in a helicopter, you don't just hover or sit in one place. You're moving in a pattern. You're circling, keeping the same altitude, and just keeping your bearings on whatever's there, mountains, hills, plains. That, and so you're keeping your bearings. And we got to 9 minutes. We had been flying in this pattern over there, and then Craig gets on with the tower, and he said, I have inadvertently gone IMC and declaring an emergency. And so he was like, I accidentally flew into the clouds. I can't see. I'm declaring an emergency. And so the tower just told all the planes, pull back. Everyone move out of the way.
Yes, get the heck out.
Give them a wide berth. Mm-hmm. And his directions were fly to 8,000 feet and go north. Nothing's going to hit you at 8,000 feet. The airport is at 4,200 feet.
Okay.
Right? And so we were probably 300 to 500 feet off the deck. And so they're like, go 3,000 or 4,000 feet up in the air. Just get some altitude.
And get out of that fog.
Get your bearings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on what they see on radar, like at the tower, it's not like a GPS. But the tower said, after they gave him those instructions, is that he didn't change the direction he was going. Nothing changed. And then suddenly within, the tower is calling, trying to get a hold of Life Flight 6. And we're not responding. And they call on three different transponders, and we're not responding.
What do you think happened?
And there's a couple of different thoughts, but with Craig being so astute at teaching this very problem, and he ran into it. There's a couple of things on the helicopter that will give you information on your instruments as you're flying. And there are these tubes that are like little, they're big spikes coming out of the helicopter. And air goes into them, and it gives information like altitude and airspeed and your artificial horizon, give you information there. And they think there was a possibility that while we're flying in the fog and the smog and that inversion, that those tubes got iced up. Mm. And so they were blocked. They weren't getting any information. And so they, at that time, that's when they launched a search. And it was Salt Lake City, like the airport paramedics were listening to the radio. We're listening to the radio traffic between Life Flight and the tower. And they said, usually when AirMed or Life Flight comes on the tower, we just kind of listen in, mm-hmm. kind of see where they're going, see what their clearance is, that kind of stuff. And this one medic was like, guys, we got to go. And they started looking. And it was about 45 minutes later that a new police officer found us. We weren't where they thought they would find us, so they kept adding people to help search, and they found us. We were about 5600 West and I-80. We were over, there's a, R.C. Willie. I think it's like a scratch and dent or a warehouse, and we landed out in their field. And so it's they...
Very off course.
It was, we weren't where they thought or probably where we thought we were. But what we're... Right at that point, we're right by I-80. That's where we're headed. We're headed west to Wendover.
Yeah.
But for 9 minutes, we were circling in a pattern. So we had canceled that and decided to return to base. And so that's obviously where we ran into problems. And so they find us and throw me in an ambulance. And
so let me stop there for a second. Ahead. When they found you, was the helicopter, did it come down hard and crash and there's debris everywhere? Were you thrown from the helicopter? Was there fire involved? You know, what describe the scene of what they came on.
Yeah, good question. So that was one of the problems was they couldn't find us because they couldn't see. And they thought, well, there's going to be like maybe some fire or maybe... some kind of sound
or smoke,
but it was just so hard to see. And so they were almost just, they stumbled upon it.
Oh.
And so when they got there, like our strobe lights, you could barely see them. You had to be, you know, within 20 feet before they saw them. And so what happened is, Craig got too close to the ground and had a glancing blow and hit the ground, and our helicopter, a K2, Augusta K2, it was made for the Swiss Alps. It's made for the altitude, and that's why IHC bought these, because they knew we'd be flying in the mountains and doing a hoist rescue and stuff. And so this helicopter has three wheels on it, or in the winter we put.
Skids,
little ski pads on the wheels.
Yeah.
And so when we hit that first time, it was kind of a glancing blow, but that first hit probably, ruined or destroyed any shock absorption that the helicopter has.
Mm.
And the front wheel, surmised that it came up and probably broke Craig's legs. And so...
So then he can't operate the helicopter with his legs.
Can't steer it. Yep.
Yeah.
Has no way to steer it, right? And so we hit and we go back up. And I should say, in the back where Mario's sitting, I'm sitting in the front, big captain's chairs. I'm sitting right next to the pilot. The only thing between us is just a bar that's really like the gas pedal. They have the collective right in there, and there's you know, not knowing too much about the ship. I flew in for years, but it's been 20 years ago. But Craig is flying right front, and Mario is sitting behind him in the back, and. When we were taken off, I remember asking Mario, saying, the front seat is usually for the paramedics because all the radios are up there and the paramedics are really good at working the radios and finding who they need to call. And the nurse would sit in the back. Well, I had just gotten home from climbing in Africa for a month, carrying backpacks around and going up and down, you know, Mount Kenya, Mount Kilimanjaro, and things like that. And my back was just so sore. And for me to sit in the back seat, you're in one of those jump seats and you have a helmet on. So for me to sit upright, my head is cocked almost to a 45 degree angle. So I would usually slouch down so my head would just barely hit the ceiling and my lower back is just taking the brunt of that. You know, it's a four blade rotor system, two jet engines, you know, just this massive transmission. And I'm like, oh man, you know, 30 minutes of that going out and 30 minutes coming back. And I was like, Mario, let me have the front seat for one of these legs. And the paramedic always sits in the front seat coming back, because we'll flip that seat around and they'll be right there.
Yeah,
by
the patient, you'll be, and so it's important that you're right there where you can work on the patient the nurse. And
Okay. And Mario was more than happy to oblige and let me sit up front. And so Craig and Mario are both on the right side. So that first hit, as we hit the ground, we lose this shock absorption. And afterwards, they could see like this debris falling off the helicopter, and we did like almost this half moon, half a mile long arc, and then we just landed again flat. And so however high we were, 50 feet, 250 feet, we just, it was just this flat landing. And so a lot of this stuff shifted away from my side and shifted over to their side. And
what did that do?
And so really, I was talking with Mario's wife, and as Mario was sitting in the back, I knew that he was crushed by the weight of the transmission and the jet engine above
him. And that would have been you if you were in that seat. Yep. If you guys wouldn't have changed that night, that would have been you that was crushed.
Yep. And I said, I am so sorry. I mean, and I'm talking to her years after the funeral, and I'm telling, and I said, do you mind me asking? I'm sure you guys had a closed casket funeral. And she goes, oh no. It was open casket. And I'm trying to figure this out, like, how? And she said, his head was, I'm trying to think of how to put this lighter. His head was just pushed into his chest. And so all they did was straighten him out.
I see.
Okay,
so there was the captain, the pilot, and Mario, and you, and one other, right?
We had
just the three of you.
Yeah,
just the three. And of the three of you, the pilot and Mario were both killed that night. And so
correct. Yeah, and so they as they took 45 minutes to find us, I was still sitting there, buckled in my chair with my helmet on, and as this Salt Lake police officer found us, she said it was this really kind of eerie situation, because she found us and she wanted to check on the other two, and I was telling her, they're already dead.
You just knew it by looking at them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so her next problem was, how do I tell people where I am? Because I don't know where I am. I need to get some paramedics over here so we can get him transported. And that came to yelling and blowing a whistle. And that's how people found us. Got me out of there. I got back up to LDS Hospital. And so I come into the trauma room, and it's nice that I don't remember this. You know, when your friends and coworkers are cutting your clothes off and poking and prodding, you know, every orifice, and there's a lot going on all at once. And they took some x-rays of my spine, of my vertebral column, and they knew I wasn't feeling or moving anything from the waist down. That was they were establishing that. But when the x-ray went up on the board and everyone looked over at it, it was just this, it was just this complete hush. Because, I mean, Bob, even if you didn't have, you don't have any medical training in reading x-rays, if I showed you this x-ray today, you would look at it and say, that's bad. You know, having my spinal cord displaced so far.
And it was so, just for a visual, as you went down the spine, the lower section was completely shifted over.
Correct.
Like inches.
Correct, over. Yeah. And they look at this, and that's when my wife had been pacing back and forth, and she knows these three guys went out on this flight, and she knows that her husband's in the trauma room, and she knows only one's coming back. And my wife is like that. She is very grounded in that. The ER doc came out, and he was like, Michelle, I'm going to tell you about some of his injuries. He has a head injury. He's got this subarachnoid head bleed. He's got broken ribs. We've put in two chest tubes. He's got blood clots in his lungs. But the biggest problem is he is not moving anything from the waist down. And Michelle, there's no way he'll ever walk again. And Michelle's thought was, well, I don't care. Because I know that two other ladies are getting the news that their husbands will never come home. And she is a person that is able to put perspective in really quick. And when she, let me back, so the ER doc tells us that. The trauma surgeon is there, and she sees me, and she comes out and tells my wife the same thing. She was like, there's no way that he'll ever be on his feet again. Then I had two neurosurgeons that came in and saw me, and they came out and told my wife the same thing. They said, you know, we'll take him to surgery, we'll fix the damage, but that's not going to make him walk again. And so when my family got to go into the room, my wife, she's 8 months pregnant. And my first words to her were, how's the baby? And she, it was so comforting to her to hear those words. Because she was like, I don't know if this is going to be my husband in there. I know he's hit his head. I don't know where he is.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, right? That's a good point, Stein. And because here you were normal at the in the moment and concerned about the brand new baby that's about to be born, and she know, oh, he's not brain dead, he's not had such trauma to his head that he's going to be a complete different man and paralyzed.
Exactly.
She was really kind of seeing the good things, as small as they were in the moment, she was seeing the good things out of the whole picture.
And that's what she,
that's admirable,
she's done the whole time I've ever known her. And so I'm sitting there talking to her, and my brain injury comes in, and my wife would say, I would say something like, we hit something. And she's like, yeah, you hit the ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to just tell the patient facts.
Right.
You know, and just try and, but I couldn't wrap my head around it. And I would think, no, we were flying, we hit something midair. And she's like, no, you hit the ground.
Interesting.
And just trying to
make sense of
things. Yeah, and it wasn't.
So
Stein, what was your feelings knowing that you just lost two friends? You lost your pilot and you lost the paramedic. What went through your mind when did you have tremendous grief immediately, or was it hard to wrap your head around?
No, not immediately. I think it took me a lot of time to realize maybe that they were gone, and that and that's sort of when the survivor's guilt kind of started to creep in, that kind of stuff. But it was much, much later. It was just it was just interesting to see how the sequence of events and you know how I ended up back where we took off from, and here I am getting cared for by these people that I joke around with, and just hang out with, and so it was very interesting to be able to be a patient, to be someone that I always would take care of.
Yes,
I would always take care of you.
Right,
you're the one.
You're the receiver now.
Yeah, and for me to be on the receiving end, it wasn't natural. I would rather. Oh, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And they're like, you're gonna start your own IV, huh? And it's like, so my course. I mean, they sent me up to. Up to shock trauma ICU. Like I said, I've got a couple chest tubes. I'm talking, just laying there in bed. And the neurosurgeons, they want to operate, but they want to give me this humongous bolus of steroids to try and shrink the swelling of my spinal cord. And so this bolus takes 24 hours. And so they wait a full day before I go to surgery. They take me down to surgery the following day. A thoracic surgeon first does a bronchoscopy, sucks out a lot of blood out of my lungs to help me ventilate and oxygenate. And then they flip me over face down and do surgery on my back for eight hours.
Yeah.
And so
extensive.
So it was really, they were just putting my lumbar spine back together. I just putting stuff where it should go. And then they put two rods on either side and screwed those in.
Basically fusing your spine.
Mm-hmm. And they took a chunk of bone off of my hip, made some bone paste, and then lined parts of the vertebrae so bone would start growing
there
together.
Yeah.
And so they explained it to me like it's sort of like the metal is like rebar as you're laying concrete. It's like you need that concrete to cure and harden up, but that rebar is going to hold it in place for the moment, So 21 years later, I've still got all this hardware. I think I've got one broken screw and one that's backing out a little bit, but they looked at me and they're like,
darn good.
Yeah, they're like, do you want to go back in and have more surgery? I'm like, no.
So, just to put some more clarity on the situation. So at the time, you really didn't have a good, future outlook as far as total rehabilitation, getting back to normal Stein. So when you went into the recuperation and healing process, a few things. Give me just some idea of how long were you in the hospital? How long were you paralyzed? When did you see this miracle feeling start to come back and the ability that where you think, oh my gosh, I'm going to be able to walk? Things like that. Give us some idea of what happened there.
Well, as my wife is in there in the ER, just backing up a little bit, just trying to ground me and get me thinking a little bit clearer. That's when my dad and all my brothers show up, and my dad asks them, "Hey, can we give him a blessing before he goes upstairs?" And so, in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we do a blessing for healing of the sick, and so they anointed me, and my father gave me a blessing, and he is blessing me there in the ER. He is like, I bless you to walk again. You're going to do all the things that you wanted to do that you haven't done, the things that you choose to do. And I don't remember this, you know, but my wife is sitting there listening to this blessing, and she is reaching up for my dad's arm because she wanted to grab him and say, "You can't say that to him. You can't bless him with that. I've just heard the four doctors tell me otherwise."
Yeah. Yeah.
And she, you know, kind of backs down and just lets it go. But I don't remember any of that. Mm-hmm. And so I go up to ICU, I go to surgery, and when I came back from surgery, I was like this rabid animal. Like I wake up from anesthesia and I'm just shaking my head and biting on my ET tube. So no air was exchanging. You know, and I'm just shaking my head like a dog, and they're like, they're trying to get a bite block in there. They're trying to.
Well, is that normal? What was going on?
No, it was just like whoa. And the doc comes in and he's like, "Well, look how awake he is. We don't need to keep that breathing tube down." You know, and so they pull it out. So I'm breathing fine. I'm restrained. I've got both of my wrists restrained, and as my wrists are restrained, I'm laying there, and they're trying to watch me and make sure. But I start pulling out all my IVs. I have an arterial line that I pull out, and I have two chest tubes that I reached up.
Oh no!
And that's exactly what the nurse said when she saw me, as she's sitting at the desk, like, "Oh no." And by the time she got in there, I'm handing her the two chest tubes. And she's like, "Oh, man, you know.
This is bad."
And the doctor comes in, and she's panicked, and he looks at her. He looks at me. I'm doing fine. And he basically says, you know, we probably leave those in too long anyways. Hmm. He was just like.
Wow. But you were in charge there.
But that's for sure. My wife comes in and she's like, "Hey, Stein, you pull everything out. They're not going to have anything to monitor. They're going to have to send you to a different unit." So that's when I ended up in rehab. And I spent 4 weeks down in rehab. And at first they thought, "You're just going to have to lay flat in bed because we don't want you to sit up, and we don't want you to bend at the waist at all. No turning from the waist type stuff. We want that area immobilized." And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I can do this. Well, after a day, you realize this isn't doable. That was about the time that someone from an orthotic, not an orthotic, people that make my ankle braces. Oh gosh, it's the guys at Hanger Orthotic, Hanger. They're gonna kill me for that. But he came in and he was like, "I can make a body brace for him."
A clamshell.
And so this went from the top of my chest, underneath my arms, all the way down to my hips, and then there was a piece that went down my left leg to just above my knee. And so it had a front piece and a back piece. And so it took several days for the from them to make this. So when they get this, it took five nurses and they roll me side to side, get me in this clamshell and put me in it. And then they lift me into this wheelchair with the back is all leaned back and my feet are up, you know, to kind of counterbalance. And so I can't move, I can't bend at the waist, right? And so I'm like, oh, okay. And I'm almost laying flat in this wheelchair. And you think, well, this is great. I'll get around like this. And
horrible.
This physical therapist comes in. And she looks at me, and she starts telling me all these things we're going to do. Ba-bum, bum, bum. And I'm like,
all things, meaning positive. You're going to accomplish this stuff. Oh, yeah. She wasn't taking the fact that you're paralyzed. She's like, we're going to fix this.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Cool is that?
Yeah. And she was just like, this. And she enumerates all these things that we're going to do. And she says, we're going to go down to the physical therapy room. Out the hall, turn left. At the nurse's station, turn right and go all the way down that hall. So I'm up in the wheelchair for the first time, and I've had people do stuff, everything for me, ever since the crash. I haven't done anything, right? And I'm sitting there, and I sort of like I'm getting ready, like I'm, okay, I'm ready to go. And Misty is standing there, and she folds her arms and she says, let's go. And
expecting you to do it, not her.
I'm like, well, I'm thinking I didn't hear you right. You know? And I sort of show her that I'm ready in the wheelchair and I'm ready for her to push me down there. And she sort of gave it that she folded her arms a little tighter and she was like, let's go. And she just kind of nodded at me. And I'm like, are you crazy, lady? I was like, what? And I remember one of my hands was cut open in the crash. And the other hand hit something. And so I had kind of this orthopedic injury. And I was like, I can't really grab very well. I'm laying down, I can't see where I'm going. My feet are out way too far in the front. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you. And it was weird. It was just like you have someone that believes. She is the person that always has hope that there will be something. Misty is a great friend to this day.
So you stayed in touch with her.
Yeah. And she is now Dr. Timpson.
How cool is that?
Yeah, and she teaches physical therapy down in Utah County. And
what's her last name?
Timpson, T-I-M-P-S-O-N. And I get to go down there every 6 months for her students to try and figure out what level of injury I have. Hmm. And I get to tell her students how she got me out of the wheelchair.
Isn't that something? Yeah, and a miracle.
It was a complete miracle. I mean, because she would come to the hospital the following day and she would say, I have this new idea. This is what we're going to do. Hmm. And I mean, day after day after day. And she just had idea after. And I remember thinking in my mind, I clearly remember thinking in my mind, and I said, Misty, go read the chart. Have you seen what they say? And she was just like, bah, ah, We're working here, right here. I want to see what you can do.
Was that kind of like out of ordinary with her? Was that just standard protocol, or was she being inspired? She was just absolutely being inspired to do some things outside the box to get you back to health and
I think,
like,
yes,
rewriting the book.
Yeah, a little bit of both, because she wasn't, she was like, hey, the sooner we can get some nerve to start firing, some muscle to start, you know, contracting, the better.
Yes.
You know, and so we want to see and try and do as much as we can right now.
So you came into my home tonight for this interview, and you walked in with the assistant. You have a little, you know, cane, but you didn't use it very much. You're walking. You're vertical. You're under your own power. You're not paralyzed. You're a gosh dang miracle. You know. So how many years after your first incident? How many years was it before you were actually vertical and starting to walk?
It was as I was initially when they got me out of bed, my only choice was to be laying down or in the wheelchair or standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so she took me from the wheelchair to the tilt table. A table, and they could put it on whatever degree angle they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, when she started getting me to be upright. And once she got me upright, I had one leg that was working. I had my right thigh that had a little bit of muscle that was working. And so she just focused on it. And my left leg, if I was upright, say if I was upright and they're helping me just move, they would put my left foot on a file folder. So it would just slide along.
Oh, yeah.
Because the body brace, it came down my left leg and, you know, stopped above the knee. And so there wasn't any hip motion working at the moment. And so she's just working everything on this right leg,
yeah,
just focusing. And they, I remember we would go for these walks and she would have one person on each foot and they would pick the foot up, and like as I walked or moved, they would make the motion with the foot. They would be kind of in this duck walk themselves down by the floor, and yeah, they'd be moving my foot. So I have one person on each foot, two people helping me stand up, and one person with a wheelchair behind me. And
that's
it
amazing.
Was just,
gosh,
it was just this huge production. Yes, yes.
Well,
and so
as we get towards the end here, I could talk to you all day long, and there's so much to say. I just want to bring this close to a closure by talking a little bit now, Stein, about this journey, this close call with death. You nearly died. Two of your friends did die, and they're gone. With this survival, would you please talk about the Stein before, the Stein during, and what the Stein is like now, what you see as far as the value of life, how you value it, what you want to accomplish going forward?
It's really interesting. Prior to the crash, I was very focused on myself and what I'm going to accomplish, what I'm going to do, what new mountain am I going to climb, and what country am I headed to do something. And the problem with that is, I spent a lot of time when I wasn't working exercising or getting ready or maybe working an extra shift to buy some more gear. I was spending less and less time with my family.
Interesting.
And there's really, I mean, I think sometimes I felt like the Lord is just like, he gives you a little bump. And he just almost like he just wants to smack you and say, wake up. Do you see what you have in front of you? And now, I mean, it's for me, it's all about family and enjoying being with them. It's weird to say, my life is better, much better. I mean, it's not like a percentage-wise. It's off the charts better after the accident. And it's like, man, if I had to go back and do it again, I tell you, life is a dream job. I loved it, absolutely. But to have that course correction and have me see what is in front of me, that's what was so super helpful to me and so eye-opening. To see my kids, to see them grow, to see how different they are. Now, like I said, 20 years later, and how different they are. Two of my kids are down in the Dominican Republic for 4 months teaching English on their own dime.
Gee, I wonder who they take after.
Two of my kids earlier last year went to Uganda and did service over there for a week.
Hey, you know what, Stein? What about that baby? You know, your wife was pregnant. I hear that she actually went into labor before you were actually released, and then you had a chance to go in where she was, and then the three of you get talk about that part.
Yeah, and my wife was one day, I'm in rehab, and she says, "I'm going to go over to labor and delivery for a minute." And I'm like, "Sure." And she walks over to the front desk, and the nurses are sitting there, and she says, "I'm going to have my baby today." And they look at her like,
"Yeah, whatever."
And so they have to hook her up, and, you know, they see that nothing's going on. They call the doc, and her doctor's just like, just release her, just discharge her. And at that very moment, the nurse is going to take these leads off, and our baby had this late deceleration. My wife had a little bit of a contraction, and his heart rate slowed, which is a ominous sign. Like, that's like, oh, we got to get this baby out now. And so she calls the doctor, and he's like, well, she's got to stay. And so they get her started on a Pitocin drip and epidural. They found a room that's big enough for both of us and brought my bed over. So we sat in there together. And
you were the bearded lady in the maternity ward.
Yep. I had about a month
growth. Oh, my gosh.
The bearded lady there. And so she delivers, and then we go out to postpartum, and the bearded lady followed. And then another couple days later, we all went home together.
How cool is that?
That was amazing.
What a heck of a story.
Yeah, and so our youngest, Zachary, has been my timeline. Sometimes I'm like, gosh, how long has it been since the crash? I'm like, well, how old is Zachary?
How long it's been.
He's 11? Okay, it was 11 years ago. And he is... He is my rock, because he always keeps me grounded. He's always he took 2 years and went to school, and he was just playing soccer for junior college, and then he's like been home for the last 6 months, and it's just been so nice.
How old is he now? The baby.
21.
21. My gosh, that's incredible. Incredible. Yeah. Well, support crew, family, kids, life, friends, just, you know, give a shout out. Who was it got you through all this?
My wife, 100%. And Bob, I would be coming to you today in a wheelchair if it wasn't for her. I'm not
kidding. That gives me chills. Seriously. Yeah.
And so it what gives me chills is to think where I was taking my life prior to. And right. and sometimes you think, this is so bad. This is you know, I've had the worst luck and stuff, and it's like, you know, I'm going to make you take your weak things and make that your strength. I'm gonna lift you and strengthen you. And you think by crashing our ship, you know, and you think, could there be another way? But you know, this has been so good to me. So for me, when I have a lot of physical taken away, I'm not here. It's like, well, why am I still here? What am I going to do? And I feel a lot of times I'm like, well, I'm not here for a physical purpose. I'm not here to lift a car off of someone. I feel like it's more of a spiritual purpose. There's got to be something along those lines. And so I look for it, and I'm here, and
oh, you've had a heck of a spiritual journey.
Oh.
And as far as that's concerned, mad at God, or you're okay with God?
Oh, no, I've never been mad, never. Because what was weird was even when I started coming to my consciousness and remembering and knowing what's going on, I had a smile on my face. Like, friends would come by and see me, and I'm just smiling. And I remember thinking, you know what, I'm going to wake up from this. I'm going to wake up, and I'll go on with my life. And when I didn't, and when reality sunk in, that's when I started feeling, you know, this is a better spot. And
that's so profound.
When you start working from that point, you have so much time to perfect that. For 20 years to achieve this better life, my kids know that I have this great fondness for being on the floor, and they hear me fall, they see me fall, they're like, are you okay, and I'm like, 95% of the time, I'm like, I'm fine. I want to get up on my own, and they respect that.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. So, final thoughts. I'm kind of curious. You know, what would you tell me and tell anybody that's going to be listening to this episode? What would you say for those that are really going through one heck of a hard time? And you know, as far as encouragement. What would you say?
That I've wondered that very thing. But even coming here, what would I say? And I don't know that I've ever put my finger on it, but the difficulties and the trouble and heartache that you go through now is so worth it. Like, cause you sometimes think, I am just spinning my wheels. This is doing no good. But in reality, it's helping. There is good coming from that. Just because you can't see it right now, doesn't mean that this was a completely bad incident. And that's what I've learned, that it is. It's a lovely life. I love being here. It's so enjoyable. Love meeting people. Enjoy meeting you, Bob. That's just been beautiful.
Oh, it's a blessing for me to meet you tonight. Stein, what are you doing now as far as work? Are you working? Or are you?
I tried to go back to work. Well, I did get back to work, and I was without a cane. I wasn't doing direct patient care. I was just working as a nursing supervisor at Riverton Hospital, at Alta View Hospital, and I had a stroke.
Oh.
7 years ago.
Okay.
And that's when I had to pick my cane back up, and I haven't ever been able to get back to work.
Okay.
And so as I went through rehab again, it was mostly rehab with a speech therapist that did like neurocognitive therapy.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, you need something else to do. You need some hobbies. You need something. And we scheduled my time every day and throughout the week. And I work at the Ochre Mountain Temple one day a week. I work in my garage, on wood projects, and I fix things in the house.
Fantastic. And you're a good dad, and you're going to be a great grandfather and husband and all those things and embrace life. You're a warrior and just an amazing man. I'm so proud of you and blessed to be here to be able to listen to you. So in closing, I always mention the fact that taking time of reflection of you lets us share your experience. Becoming a part of your journey ultimately impacts ours. So until we see each other again, just stay alive to tell about it, will you, pal?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, my brother, for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I live like it's the last day of my life. Live for the things that make it right. Live for the ones that make me free. Open up your heart and you will see. Live to be proud. It's the last day.